Welcome to Sleep Junkies. My name's Jeff Mann. We cover the whole conversation on sleep. So there's a great little movie called WALL-E. It's kind of a kids animated sci-fi movie with an environmental message. But as well as being a cute little kids movie, it's quite subversive as well, because it depicts a future where technology and consumerism has got to the point where we've become so detached from our physical selves that the whole human race has become obese. Now, of course, this is science fiction, but there's no doubt since the 1980s, there's been a huge, huge increase in global cases of weight gain and obesity. That's a fact. But here's the interesting thing that relates to today's podcast. Over a similar time period in the last few decades, let's say, there's been considerable debate about whether we're becoming an increasingly sleep-deprived society. So scientists being scientists across many fields have asked the question, are these two factors, weight gain, obesity, and let's say less than optimal sleep, are these two things connected? So the very short answer is yes. We know there are multiple associations between how we sleep and our metabolism, but we kind of have to stop there and recognize that our current scientific understanding is a chicken and egg situation. So we don't know if increased weight gain is driving more sleep loss, or is our sleep-deprived society causing more people to put on more weight. So that's an extremely broad and slightly crude outline of what we're talking about today. Because what we're going to do, I'm talking to a professor of neuroscience, a sleep researcher, someone who also knows all about human nutrition, and we're going to get into the weeds a little bit. We're going to try and break this topic down into a few different themes, just to illustrate that if you want to really unravel this question of is there a connection between sleep and obesity, you need to take a real multidisciplinary approach to answering the question. So we're going to chunk this down a little bit. We're going to look at the brain. We're going to talk about how the brain perceives food when we're sleep deprived and how that can lead to really bad food choices. We're going to talk about energy expenditure and sleep deprivation and physical activity and body composition. We're going to talk a little bit about timing issues, when we eat, how that affects our overall circadian processes and how that impacts on our sleep and vice versa. The hunger hormones that are impacted by sleep loss, the relationship between sleep and the types of foods, the type of diet we eat. So yeah, this is a huge topic and new research is coming out all the time, so there's no way we can be exhaustive, but we're talking to a real expert who's got a fantastic overview of the subject, and I'm sure anyone who's interested in how these two things connect, weight gain, obesity, and sleep, I'm sure you'll find this really interesting. This podcast is a fact-rich environment, so we've broken it down into two parts to make it more easily digestible for you. So if you're liking the podcast and what we do here at Sleep Junkies, go ahead, leave us a review, join our Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide, check out the website, sleepjunkies.com. We're all over social media. We don't have any corporate sponsors. We'll never have any ads on the podcast. So any way you can support us, we really, really appreciate it. Anyway, enough from me. Let's get on with the show. Good morning, everyone. I'm joined on the other end of the line, all the way from Sweden, with Associate Professor Christian Benedict. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Jeff.
Well, I am super, super excited to have Christian on the line today. And we talked about this months and months ago. We're talking about the connections between sleep and obesity and diet and weight gain. It's a big, big topic. And we've kind of been going backwards and forwards. And so it's been a long time coming, this conversation. Christian heads up a department at Uppsala University in Sweden. So the Benedict Lab I'm just paraphrasing from your homepage here. So you study the effects of circadian disruption and sleep loss and health and performance in humans. And you've got a particular focus on the relationship between sleep loss and metabolism. Now, I sort of Google stalked you a little bit, and I saw you've got about 160 publications on ResearchGate. Mm-hmm. You've got dozens and dozens of publications coming out of the lab. I see you all the time being quoted in newspapers, in the popular press on these subjects. You've got a lot going on there, haven't you?
Yeah, I have actually even written a book about sleep.
Tell us about the book.
There are many books, right, available about the topic sleep and how sleep influences our health and performance. But I thought, you know, it's really time to write also a book where we put a positive spotlight on sleep, because I have the impression, you know, nowadays everyone is speaking about sleep in a very negative way. You know, we are all sleep deprived, we all have sleep issues, and if you don't sleep 7 hours as recommended for adults, then your life will be messed up, you will be an underperformer, and so forth. And I really thought, you know, it's very important to highlight, you know, the coin has always two sides. Yes, it's not so simplistic as you might think if you read newspapers, right, that you sleep only 6 hours, then your life is already a mess. I don't believe this, because there are many lifestyle factors, genetics and your environmental factors, that have an influence on your health. Sleep is definitely one pillar of this, but it's not the only one, yes? And it's very important. You know, if you think about people that have sleep problems, I always say this, you know, and they come to you and say, I sleep only 5 hours every night. Should I be worried? And, you know, I think we should not say to these people, yes, you should be worried. You know, studies have clearly shown that you will go up in weight, you may develop, I don't know, horrible diseases, and you may die earlier. No, you should say, hey, we have here a starting point, and how could we further improve this? How could we create better conditions to invite sleep? Yes,
I've seen it out and about. I don't think it's in English yet, is it?
So it has been written in Swedish and released in Sweden in 2018, and now it's also available in Germany, which is of course really cool for me, because I'm a German, and that's of course a cool honor to have a book about sleep science in German. And it will also be released in Russia and Estonia in 2020. But so far, it has not been published in English. But that's not so surprising, because, you know, there are many famous sleep scientists that have already written sleep books about this. So it's quite a competitive market, right, isn't it?
Yeah, but we could do with a book, you know, with a positive spin.
Yeah, precisely. So I could use your podcast to promote my book.
There you go. Well, maybe we'll do a little poll, you know, and we'll get some support for an English version.
Yes. So, as you pointed out, so I'm a sleep researcher, and I'm also author to a book about the effects of sleep on mental and physical well-being. And I'm also father to 4 children that are 15, 14, 13, and 11 years old. But not only this, you know, when I was a doctoral student, I performed my studies under the supervision of Jan Born. And Jan Born is a really well-known sleep researcher, especially in the field of how does sleep improve memory consolidation? Why do we have to sleep on things to come to a solution? Why does sleep promote insight into problems that I experienced during preceding wakefulness and so forth? And I thought, you know, this is quite exciting and interesting, but Jan was not really interested in the effects of sleep loss. And given the sleep loss that I experienced because of my kids, I thought I should fill this gap. And given my background, because I hold a master's degree in nutritional science with a focus on nutritional medicine, I thought this is something that I would like to address. Yes, this is something that I would like to do. I moved in 2009, and the end of 2009, because I got funding from the Swedish Research Council, I moved to Sweden. And since then, I'm here.
And what was the impetus between setting up the lab? So you've got your own sort of little James Bond laboratory there, haven't you?
Yeah,
your own specialist research.
So I started to work as a postdoctoral researcher in Helgi Schiert's lab. He's a geneticist here at Uppsala University and also specialized in molecular biology techniques. And I thought, this is really cool. This is something that I would like to utilize in my research. And one very important person that I met also in the beginning of my time here at Uppsala University was Jonathan Sidenes. I know that he was on your podcast on a previous episode. He's a medical doctor.
Big shout out to Jonathan.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this was of course brilliant to collaborate with a medical doctor. So he worked as a postdoc in my lab and to start these cool studies. And then I got also considerable funding from various funding agencies in Scandinavia, which allowed me to become more independent, to take care of my PhD students or to have PhD students. And yeah, here I am. Now I'm an associate professor of neuroscience. I'm responsible for a small but very productive and enthusiastic team. And this is what I always want to have.
Fantastic. And if that's not enough on your plate, yourself and Jonathan, you also run the Sleep Science Facebook group as well, which is where we kind of connected initially, which is brilliant because you're not just stuck in your ivory towers of academia and research. You're actively trying to put the word out and promote and disseminate this information, which is really, really important. And I don't think there's enough people out there in sleep research disseminating this work, because it's almost impossible to keep up with all the science, isn't it? And
yes.
But if anyone is interested in sleep science, go to Facebook and join the sleep science group, and it's a great way to keep up.
Yeah, and I'm extremely proud of this group, because you know, I started this group when I moved to Uppsala, because I was a little bit sad, you know, that I have no longer connection to sleep researchers. And I thought, you know, this is a way to, you know, stay connected with people interested in sleep science. And I never expected it would grow into something so cool, yes, that we have more than 1,000 members. And as you already mentioned, you know, just join this group. Everyone is more than welcome to join this group, share new findings.
You don't have to be a scientist. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a scientist. Of course, you don't have to be a scientist. Yes, I can tell you, you know, when I give also quite often popular scientific lectures, and quite often you get really brilliant questions from the audience, from the layman, yes? And this is good. They can be also very inspirational. So we have to be aware that we should not be arrogant and just think because we are scientists, we know everything better, yes?
Well, like myself, we both like to talk.
Yeah.
But let's try and
focus.
Let's
on
try
the
and tackle this yeah. this huge topic. And as I said before, we're going to try and join the dots. And this is your speciality, yourself and your lab, sleep and the circadian process of the body and metabolism and diet and obesity. And you sent me a presentation. Is it something you do for your students, your undergraduates?
For medical students. Mm.
And it's very useful because it's kind of breaking down this topic into several different themes, because there's so many different ways to look at this topic. And broadly, you know, we could say, you know, what's the connection between sleep and weight gain, or sleep and obesity, or sleep and metabolism? But even within that, there's so many different rabbit holes you can dive into, and this is what you're doing in your lab. But we're gonna sort of try and take this apart a little bit, and not, you know, we can't be exhaustive on this subject, but we're gonna look at different aspects.
Yes.
So we're gonna try and take this apart a little bit, and we might go off track. We'll try and keep on track, and I'm sure, you know, we're going to come back to this topic again on the podcast. If we can first start off with the topic of obesity, let's say, apart from sleep. So it's kind of, it's incontrovertible, the evidence that we've seen a big trend since the 1980s in a worldwide increase in obesity.
Yes.
And at the same time, there's also been studies linking short sleep duration mm-hmm. with a higher risk of obesity. But I wondered if you could start off with giving us the kind of the scale of the issues that we're talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, we, based on survey data, we know that, and also, of course, international investigations, we know that many, many people nowadays have a body mass index that is greater than 25. You know, if it is greater than 25, but smaller than 30, you're considered overweight. If it is above 30, you're considered obese. And there you can have even a severe obesity if you have an even higher BMI. And they have found in, you know, analyses involving many, many countries around the world that up to 40% of adults, yes, have either an overweight or obesity. And this is, of course, that means, you know, if you just turn this into some numbers, 40 out of 100 among 100 people are either overweight or obese, yes, in the adult population. And this is, of course, too much. And we see also this does not only concern the adult population, this concerns also children and teenagers, yes, because also there you see that about a quarter either suffer from overweight or obesity. And this is something that is, of course, alarming and warrants further investigation. Why does this happen? And there has been some interest in sleep because, you know, we see that the sleep sleep loss epidemic somehow has paralleled the obese epidemic. Yes, more and more people nowadays don't sleep sufficiently. There is, for instance, this international bedroom poll in 2013 from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and they have found that about between 30 to 40% of people say, I have issues to sleep the recommended 7 hours per night on a regular basis. I have issues with the quality of my sleep and so forth. So you see that these are two epidemics, but the question is, are they interacting? And what you can do in order to investigate this is you go to population studies and check, okay, is there any association? We ask people that participate in population studies, how well do you sleep? How long do you sleep? And of course, you can also assess their body weight and height. And based on that, you can calculate this BMI, which is used as a measure of to classify people in either underweight, normal weight, overweight and obesity. And what they have seen in many of these studies, there is apparently an association with, if we focus now on sleep duration, in that you have like a kind of U-shaped function. That means those sleeping too short, less than the recommended 7 hours, they have an increased risk to be obese or to become obese in the future. But we have also to admit that those regularly sleeping too long, yes, too long is, of course, sounds a little bit strange, but that means longer than 9 hours per night, they have also an increased risk to develop obesity. But, you know, as you already pointed out, this is such a huge field. Let's focus now on the short sleep part of this association. But the point is, okay, you see then this association. And they have even done meta-analyses where you just try to collect all the available evidence coming from population-based studies to see, is there like a systematic association between these two variables of interest? That means on the one hand, the obesity or overweight, and on the other hand, short sleep duration. And they indeed found, yeah, you know, for adults, you increase your risk to be obese by about 50% compared to those who sleep as recommended. That means between 7 to 9 hours. But if you check this for children, then it's even higher. Then, you know, they double the risk to be obese if they don't sleep as recommended. And of course, based on that, you could be inclined to conclude, yeah, sleep loss is here causal for that. You know, we will go up in weight because if I'm sleep deprived, I have this kind of personal experience that if I don't sleep well, I'm not only moody, I'm quite often also hungry and think that stuff that is palatable, dense and energy, you know, savory, sweet, all these kind of foods are very appealing, attractive for me, and I want to eat them. But you have, of course, to do experiments to prove this, yes? Because it could be also the other way around. You know, if you have, for instance, an obesity, obesity is known to be a risk factor for sleep apnea, and that can terminate early your sleep, and that can also result in short sleep duration. It's not true for all sleep apnea patients, but it is possible. That means you have to be careful if you think it's only in one direction. It could be also in the other direction, that obesity drives poor sleep habits, yes? Or dietary habits that you would link to obesity, like unhealthy dietary habits, possibly they contribute to poor sleep. So, well, we see based on the meta-analysis and strong kind of association between short sleep and obesity. But again, you know, you have this kind of chicken and egg scenario. You don't know, is obesity driving sleep problems because of, let's say, sleep apnea or pain in your joints, and that's why you cannot sleep, or you're physically inactive, and we know that exercise is very important to improve sleep, and if you're more sedentary, you may sleep not as good. Or is it the other way around, that short sleep duration increases your risk to gain weight? And I thought, you know, I have to address this with my research, but I'm not the only one. Of course, we have to acknowledge also the work of many other groups that have done wonderful work on this field too. But anyhow, the idea is then, okay, if sleep loss is causally driving obesity, it should induce some behaviors.
Can I just bring it back a little bit?
Yeah, you can.
We're talking today about, you know, trying to join the dots between sleep and obesity.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to say that obviously this is not the only cause, because we've also got modern lifestyles, particularly diets,
yes.
How modern diets are so energy dense, fast food,
yes.
Processed food is so readily available now. I mean, that's going to be a huge, huge factor, you know, if not the biggest factor. So my point is, we're not in any way saying that sleep loss is solely responsible for obesity, because there are...
Absolutely not. That's good that you point this out, yes.
Mm. There are many, many, many other factors, including diet and lifestyle as well. But sleep is something that's not often talked about as a contributing factor to this obesity epidemic.
And I really appreciate also that you... clarify this, yes, because it's of course very important to understand that this is like a multi-causal disease, yes. It's not like, you know, only the sleep matters in this context, but this is so true for so many diseases, yes. And this, you know, then we would come back to that what I said also, what was the motivation to write this book, yes, because you have to acknowledge this, yes, that many diseases are not just, you know, based on one factor, yes. For instance, I remember, you know, in the 80s, when I was young, you know, we had maybe once or twice a month meat because it was so expensive. Nowadays, you can eat meat around the clock, yes, because it does not cost anything,
yeah.
Yes.
Can you just very briefly mention this meta-analysis associating short sleep with risk of future obesity?
Well, there were multiple studies, population-based studies, that have established a connection between short sleep duration and your risk of obesity. But what is really important, that you systematically evaluate these results, and this you do by means of something called meta-analysis, where you gather all this evidence and check whether there is a systematic association between these two variables. A meta-analysis, for instance, published in 2014 in the journal Sleep, has shown that there is an association between short sleep duration and obesity, in that those sleeping not sufficiently have a 50% higher risk to be obese. And this was done in an adult population. But there is also a separate meta-analysis that was performed in children and teenagers. And there they found that they have a higher risk. It's twice as high. The children or teenagers are short sleepers compared to normal sleepers. But the problem with a meta-analysis is, yes, it systematically investigates the possible connection between two variables, but you don't know anything about causality. So does sleep loss drive weight gain, or is it the other way around, that weight gain or being obese has some detrimental effect on your sleep, which is certainly true, yes, but we did not know at this time is sleep loss really a causal factor in this association? That being said, we decided we have to do experiments. Yes, and with we, I mean my lab, but also labs from the US and from other European countries. Yes, and even from Asian countries, so all over the world. And the idea is, if we invite healthy, normal weight people that don't have any weight issues, and we expose them to short periods of sleep loss, do we see any changes in their behavior regarding food intake decisions? Do we see any changes in appetite hormones that signal to the brain when it's time to eat or when it's time to feel sated? Do we see these kind of changes in these people? And if yes, that could be an indication, yeah, that short sleep may increase your risk to become obese if you chronically suffer from short sleep duration.
Yeah.
And, you know, that being said, you know, the foundation for these kind of studies is, of course, the energy balance equation. It's not complicated. You know that you have, on the one hand, an energy expenditure, a daily energy expenditure. So much energy I require for, you know, my vital functions and for being physical active, for mental performance, and so forth. And on the other hand of this equation, you have calorie consumption, or just simply food intake. And the idea was always, as long as food intake matches your energy expenditure, you are fine. You won't have an issue to gain weight in future. But maybe sleep loss is either altering the energy expenditure component of this equation or the food intake component of this equation. Maybe you don't see any changes in energy expenditure, but people tend to eat more. That will result in a positive energy balance, and then in the long run, an increase of weight. Or the other way around, you know, you don't eat more, but you expend less energy when you're tired. Yes. And in order to investigate this, we, as I already said, and other labs performed a series of experiments.
Well, this is the first aspect that we wanted to tackle, this idea of food intake related to sleep loss. Now, the kind of obvious no-brainer way of looking at this is, if you're awake longer, you've got more opportunity to take food in. But putting that to one side, I wondered if you could run through a few of the studies, including some of the research that's come out of your lab related to this specific aspect of sleep loss affecting our food intake.
And, you know, I think what is really important also for the listeners is that we start with the brain, and then we continue with the rest of the body. You use your brain to make decisions, yes, to say, oh, now I feel hungry and I want to eat this, or there is something on the plate, this is attractive, appealing, I want to eat this. So we thought, okay, what is actually driving a food intake decision? On the one hand, of course, you know, things like your reward system in the brain, yes, that tells, you know, that is activated if you see something that is salient, that is appealing, like, you know, your favorite food, let's say a chocolate. You see the chocolate and you really notice, you know, oh, this is what I want to have, yes. But on the other hand, you have also, you know, some kind of cognitive capacity to withhold this response and to say, no, but, you know, now it's not time to eat. I'm now on podcast with Jeff and I cannot start eating now, yes. And we thought we should investigate this, yes. Do we see any effects on this kind of reward pathways? Do the brain perceives food in a different way? Is it more appealing? And for this purpose, we used magnetic resonance imaging. But on the other hand, we thought also to investigate, is our cognitive control related to food intake somehow influenced by sleep loss? And this we did with behavioral tasks. But I will take this step by step. So the first thing that we thought is to address is, okay, do we perceive food in a different way? And one thing that you can do is that you show people food images, right? Images of food that you consider palatable, that you really like, such as chocolate, a hamburger, or whatever it can be, yes. And we did this once our participants were sleep deprived and once they had a good night of sleep. And then they were in the scanner to measure their brain activity. And what we found was that sleep deprivation resulted in an increased activation of a part of the brain reward pathway when they viewed these images of palatable food compared to sleep. Yes. And that was, of course, really interesting because that somehow matches with personal experiences. If my kids, you know, were awake throughout the night, that the first thing that I did in the morning, that I had to eat some chocolate stuff and savory stuff and, you know, sausages and so on, because you really notice that the impacts you. So you don't have to do science for that to understand. If you are on short sleep, it changes the way how you see food, and you really crave for these sweet and savory products. Yes.
Yeah, break that down a little bit, because we're not talking about, you're not saying we're sleep deprived and we just need to eat more. You're saying we're sleep deprived, so we're craving these very energy dense foods, like, you know, junk food, let's say, which is high in, you know, sugar, fat.
I think you are nonetheless making a good point, yes, because that is definitely a confounder, yes, because if you're sleep deprived, what does that mean? Your brain is still online, yes, and you have still to process your environment, and you have a slightly higher energy expenditure. And people could imagine, okay, if I have then a higher energy expenditure in the brain, I have to compensate for this, and that's why I eat more. But what we did also in this study, we provided our participants a breakfast before they entered the scanner in order to reduce this confounding effects of just being hungry because of this energy deficit, because you did not sleep sufficiently. Yes. So you see that it looks like that sleep loss is not only causing it like a compensatory homeostatic response. I have to compensate for my nocturnal energy deficit. No, it also changes really the way how we see food. Yes. Especially the food items that are very dense in energy, that are sweet and savory, yes, like junk food or candy sensitive.
Yeah, I mean, you're using the term palatable, but yes. You know, I might use the word junk food.
Yeah,
instead,
precisely. So precisely. The other one sounds more scientifically. Yes. But you know, but we were not the only one. There were also many other studies that confirmed these findings. Yes. Because what we did was total sleep deprivation, and other studies utilized partial sleep deprivation and could also see similar patterns, that the brain reward system was really active when you're partially sleep deprived and view images of, you know, junk food, chocolate, and so forth. So you see, if we summarize the neuroimaging evidence, yes, it looks like that if we are on short sleep, our brain perceives food as more appealing, brain reward pathways are more active, and even not, you know, in response to food images, even if you expose people to food odors, they respond stronger to this, yes?
Yeah,
I mentioned, you know, when it comes to food intake decisions, on the one hand, we have these kind of, you know, old brain structures, the limbic system, being part of the reward system, saying, eat this, these are the candies that we like, they are good for us. But on the other hand, you have this annoying prefrontal cortex behind the forehead saying, no, you know, it's always trying to make rational decisions, to make an interpretation, an evaluation. What would that mean? What is the implication of our behavior if we would indeed eat these candies? Yes. And this prefrontal cortex will then say, no, this is not good for your health, this is not good for your body weight, and so forth. But if you're sleep deprived, maybe the prefrontal cortex has not the same capacity to suppress these kind of bottom-up response, this response coming from the brain reward pathways, eat these candies, yes? And we tried to test this as well, and I just briefly summarize it. We clearly see that your ability to suppress these kind of bottom-up feelings, these kind of reward feelings, is compromised if you're sleep deprived. So you lose a little bit your cognitive ability to suppress these appetitive responses. And that's quite interesting, because I mentioned to you that in children and teenagers, we see a stronger association between short sleep duration and obesity. It's twice as high if children and teenagers are short sleepers compared to normal sleepers. And you know that children and teenagers, they don't have a fully mature prefrontal cortex. It, you know, this takes up to 25 years. And if you then, you know, add sleep deprivation to a prefrontal cortex that is not, you know, ready, so to speak, in terms of its capacity to suppress these kind of things, to control impulses, yeah, then you have a mess and they are just, you know, craving for the candies and say, let's fill the bag with 4 kilograms candies.
I like this term, you know, the lizard brain. You know, so you're basically saying, you know, you show them images of a hamburger or whatever it is, some energy dense food, and the reward systems, bing, they're lighting up. So we have less control. We have fewer reasoning abilities to kind of say, actually, maybe I shouldn't be eating a hamburger at 2 o'clock in the night. We're just impaired cognitively. And that's a direct impact of sleep loss that we know is happening.
But, you know, it makes also sense if you think about this. Of course, it's a stressful thing, not to sleep, especially for the brain, But that being said, so this is what we have seen when it comes to the brain, but there's so much more to do, What happens, for instance, with your food intake decision if you're sleep deprived and exposed to stress, Because we are quite often also these kind of stress eaters, We don't know, but that's, of course, a very interesting and intriguing question. If I'm sleep deprived and, you know, my boss comes to me and says, you have to work harder, you have to do this, am I then more inclined to eat than even more? And to go for the chocolate? We don't know, but there is a good reason to believe this. So you see, there's a lot of, there are many, many open questions when it comes to the brain and how it is affected by sleep loss with regards to food intake decisions.
Okay. So one thing we haven't mentioned so far are issues to do with timing and circadian disruption. Now, we're not really going to go into depth on this podcast because that's another huge subject. But it's very, very related to what we've just been talking about. So, and it will it'll be very important, for instance, for people who are doing shifts. And this is something I want to cover in another discussion, another podcast. But that's going to have a big impact if you're circadian rhythms are disrupted. And, you know, by nature, your sleep is disrupted. There's going to be a stronger tendency to want to crave these bad foods, let's call them, which is something really important if you do work night shifts to try to bring some of these reasoning abilities into your food choices. I mean, I don't really want to go down that route today. Just wondered if you could just say a few sentences about the timing issues, because that's something that's also very, very heavily related, but we don't really have the time to go into on this podcast.
Maybe actually already speaking about it a little bit when it comes to the effects of short sleep duration, because, you know, in many studies, what they do then, they, let's say, allow them to sleep from 1 to 5. But then they wake them up, and what do? They switch on the lights, the room lights, the ceiling light. And you know that light has a strong effect on your circadian rhythm. It's really in training. And, you know, maybe what we measure here are effects of sleep loss combined with circadian disruption, But we know that shift workers run an increased risk for obesity, but also for a variety of other diseases. And, of course, circadian disruption has been shown to be really problematic when it comes to weight control. And this is especially refers to when I, for instance, eat, They have shown in animals that if animals eat during the rest period and another group of animals eat, I think these were rats, eat during the active period, and they eat the same amount, the animals that eat during the rest period go more up in weight, than those that ate only during the active period. And if you think about humans, there are also similar results, especially from Sachin Panda from the US. He has shown that, you know, if people primarily eat during the day, they show this kind of time-restricted eating. Let's say they eat from 7, 8 in the morning until 18, 1900 in the evening, you know, that these people typically are way less. These people, this is also another study from Charles Seisler, they should even show if you ate then late, then you have also an adverse body composition, you have more body fat, you have less skeletal muscle, So it's definitely true that timing of eating plays a very important role. And, you know, I studied nutritional science in the 90s, and it was so funny because we always had this kind of concept based on this energy balance equation. As long as you eat as much as you need, there won't be a change. But we have never discussed the question of when. And now we know when plays a very important role, yes? And if you think about the shift workers, and which have irregular work schedules, especially also the night shift workers, if they then eat in the night, you know, what do they typically eat? First of all, they eat at all, which is not good because their body is not prepared to process food. Mm. And on top of that, there is no canteen or whatever. They go to the vending machine. And what is in the vending machine? Yeah. Only, you know, energy dense, palatable food, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is, of course, really problematic because during this time, they cannot process this. And then they fill their body also with a lot of problematic macronutrients. I just want to add this with the brain. You know, these studies have, of course, shown that, okay, and I think you summarized this nicely, the reward pathway is more active, whereas these kind of structures that are important for suppress this kind of appetitive responses are less active. And, of course, does that mean that we then actually eat also more? And there have been studies on this to investigate this, and they found that people indeed eat more. A meta-analysis tried to summarize all these experimental findings in relation to how much do people eat on short sleep, and they found that people on average eat about 250 kcal more per day if they are on short sleep. And that's quite interesting. Why? If you think about the energy equivalent of 1 kilogram body fat, yes, this is about 9,000 kcal, and that means that you need for about 1 month of this kind of short sleep situation. And if this is true, that this kind of 250 kcal is that what you would eat more in 1 month, you have added 1 kilogram body fat, yes, and that's of course amazing if you think about, you know, that so many people run on poor sleep for such long periods. Myself also, you know, because of my kids, yes, when I compare this, how much at the time before I received my, or before my kids came into our family, and now I definitely went up in weight, and it's for sure my poor sleep that contributes to this.
Yeah. Mm. I kind of attribute it that way sometimes, or maybe it's just, you know, I'm eating more or drinking more beer at night, or maybe
you see, Jeff, and that's why we have an audio podcast and not a video podcast.
Yeah, I've got three hamburgers lined up next to me here.
Yeah, precisely. But altogether, so the effects on the brain translate also in increased food intake per day. That's very important to keep in mind, yes. But one thing that is also very important, you know, as I already mentioned, you see that these effects persist even after you have eaten something, yes? And that's why we sometimes say, despite satiety, people say, yeah, I feel sated now, they are sleep deprived, and you re-expose them to some kind of tests where you want to investigate their food intake behavior, yes? You see that they still choose, for instance, larger portions of snack items, yes? Or they still eat more. And that's, of course, interesting because, you know, because then you apparently eat, yet you feel sated. And that has something to do more with this kind of hedonic eating, yes? And sleep loss apparently really drives this as well, yes? So I think a first take-home message that we can have is sleep loss has an impact on food intake, and that it increases food intake. And that can, if not compensated by energy, by an increase of energy expenditure, of course, then result in an increased risk of weight gain.
Right. Let's park that message.
Yeah.
An awful lot to take in there. All really, really useful stuff, and still a lot of ongoing research.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. That was part one of our discussion of exploring the connections between sleep and obesity. Part two is coming up next week. In the meantime, don't forget, check us out on social media. Check out the website, sleepjunkies.com, and join our Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide. See you on the next episode.